succession is to be on German church ordinances. The importance of this subject, I suppose, is the fact that just as there's more of doctrine defined in Latin Christianity during the 16th century than in all of the centuries before and after put together, there was probably more construction of ecclesiastical institutions done in that century than had been done in the previous and succeeding periods. Our papers today deal with two regions of Western Germany, in Old Germany. The first paper this morning will deal with Hesse. The reader is Professor John C. Stalnaker, a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, and who is now teaching at the University of Cincinnati. Professor Stalnaker will speak on the subject of Christian discipline and social control in Hesse.
My topic is social control. Social control, social discipline, or to use the language often found in 16th century ecclesiastical legislation. Social control, socialism, or to use the language often found in 16th century ecclesiastical legislation, Christian discipline. This subject has claimed on our attention as 16th century historians for several reasons. Princes, urban magistrates, Protestant superintendents, and Catholic bishops were trying in the 16th century to steadily increase the vigor and attention to detail and systematic methods to impose such discipline or control on their subjects. That is to say, to regulate behavior, which had in the past been regulated only fitfully, ineffectively, or not at all. Furthermore, territorial princes were trying, frequently trying to impose throughout their principalities controls which had previously been attempted only by the tighter administration of imperial or territorial cities. Church attendance and village feasting, fornication and the wearing of silk, horse calling, begging, and blasphemy are examples of the many concerns of the voluminous, often pedantic and ill-tempered, and often repeated pages of the regulations and exhortations which flow from the chancery and the privy presses of central European governments, more ecclesiastical effectively. The novelty and the historical importance of this sustained and widespread effort to modify much traditional behavior of subjects and parishioners has been recognized. Professor Gerhard Erstreich, for example, in an important essay, has gone so far as to speak of Sozialdisziplinierung, or social disciplining, as the characteristic or distinctive activity of the early modern European states. Professor Dorwart has recently devoted a book to the subject of social discipline in early modern Prussia. Nor have church historians neglected this subject as any students of Calvin or Luther know. So unfortunately, I cannot claim to be reviving a long neglected subject. What I can claim and do is that the treatment of this subject has often been deficient because too narrow. Social discipline is a concern in which both secular and religious motives and consequences meet and interpenetrate. But historians of the state have sometimes tend to neglect its religious side, and historians of the church or churchmen its secular side. Furthermore, church historians are sometimes interpreted in a rather grand or undifferentiated way, at least undifferentiated way, the position of a churchman or a theologian on Christian discipline as a direct expression of general philosophical or theological principles, such as the conceptions of evangelical freedom or the conceptions of the liberties of the church, without, that is, taking into account more limited and more mundane considerations which may have influenced this churchman or theologian. But this is to unduly restrict a rich topic. For around the issue of Christian discipline revolve not only weighty dogmatic principles, but also the issue, repeatedly debated in the 16th century, of the practical authority of clergymen vis-a-vis that of the civil government and of its agents. And the debate over and the attempted implementation of Christian discipline concerned on both the larger question of justification of such discipline and smaller questions of how it was to be most effectively implemented. In other words, churchmen and statesmen of the first half of the 16th century were, to take the phrase which Baron Müller has applied to Luther, responsive to events, or responsive to political context, in my, as far as my topic is concerned. And we must be too, if we are to understand. I'm going to try to demonstrate these claims and generalities by discussing the genesis of a particular piece of Hessian legislation, a piece of legislation which promoted the ecclesiastical enforcement of social discipline or control by means of excommunication, and with the aid of an official new to the Hessian Church, the elder. The title of this decree is the Ziegenheimer Zuchtordnung, or the Ziegenheim Disciplinary Ordinance, promulgated in 1539 by the authority of Landgrave Philip for application throughout his dominions. This legislation has been seen as formative of the constitution and the doctrine of the Hessian Protestant Church. And the Hessian Protestant Church, as you all know, the church which is prominent among Central European churches for a couple of reasons, or at least a couple of reasons. One is the size and central location of the territory, and the other is the political vision and daring and influence of its ruling Landgrave. So this legislation has intrinsic as well as exemplary importance. The foremost architect of this legislation was Martin Luther, chief Strasbourg clergyman, summoned to Hesse in 1538 on special commission by the Landgrave. The issues and the problems which Luther faced in Hesse were familiar to him from his long experience in Strasbourg. He speaks then for the same doctrinal and constitutional principles, the same general doctrinal and constitutional principles in Hesse that he had long represented in Strasbourg. But the political context is different, and this may for a marked difference in the way in which these larger principles were applied. This paper has its center in Hesse. It analyzes the policies and principles of the Ziegenheim legislation and the problems it was intended to solve. But the experiences of Luther and of others in Strasbourg are kept in view, since the comparison helps to highlight the distinctiveness of the Hessian situation. Let me give now a brief summary of the beginnings of the Hessian Reformation and the particular problems faced in Hesse in the first decade of the Reformation. It begins in 1526, or rather, it's authorized in 1526. The Reformation. We have systematic visitation and conversion of parishes and monasteries beginning early in 1527, and this process proceeded rapidly in Hesse. But the first representatives of the Hessian clergy were immediately confronted by a challenge from native Anabaptists. The first Anabaptists were arrested on Hessian soil in 1528, and between then and the mid-1530s, the apprehension and interrogation of well over 100 Anabaptists by Hessian officials and the imprisonment and the banishment of their leaders is not seen to have blunted the appeal of the sectarians to the general Hessian population. Hessian authorities then were understandably alarmed. And they were the more alarmed because Anabaptist defection was not the only serious difficulty facing the innocent Protestant church. Hessian Protestant clergymen were also being met by ill will and sullen indifference among a disturbing proportion of the laity who, in contrast to the Hessian Anabaptists, did not formally reject the tenets of the newly established church. Startled and resentful complaints by clergymen who felt themselves to be ill-used and despised by their parishioners multiplied and had become commonplace in the decade after 1526. Not principled withdrawal or argument as among the Anabaptists, but inarticulate deeds were the means by which this type of popular ill will toward the new church and its personnel were expressed. Townsmen, peasants, and noblemen were helping themselves to church property and clerical income, sometimes with what seems to us to be astonishing openness. Sermons were badly attended, and those parishioners who were not working or making merry elsewhere on Sunday morning often gathered outside the church, chattering so noisily that services were disturbed. Clergymen were threatened and harassed on the street. Now, the reasons for the underlying discomfort of the Hessian Protestant clergy is not something I'm going to do anything. I'm going to go into it later. It's another subject. But I want to make some suggestions on this matter. Passion Reformation involved not only innovations in theology, religious practice, and ecclesiastical jurisdiction, but also contained ingredients of Reformatio in an older and more universally accepted sense, the restoration of ostensibly Christian manners and mores. The new church demanded more of its parishioners and heavier, and for a number of reasons. One is certainly the greater efficiency of an ecclesiastical administration, which is now functioning within a solely territorial framework, permits heavier demands on laity and on clergy. Popular unrest during the transition period, they are talking about the boundary and the aftermath of boundary. Popular unrest during the transition period seemed to have required new measures of social control in which clergymen participated. And finally, zealous reformers who believed themselves to have restored the true church may have assumed that higher standards of popular conduct and popular piety were called for. Whatever the reason, or whatever the mix of the reasons that some of the reasons I've indicated, the emphasis on control and on discipline of parishioners is contemporaneous with the origin of the Reformed Church, and that emphasis grows more pronounced in succeeding years. So we have that in the first decade of Protestantism in Hesse, territorial legislation requiring that sermons be attended and heard, quote, with inner and outer reverence, blasphemy, adultery, drunkenness, and slanderous attacks on clergymen were prohibited. Now, for the average sensual man, such measures were entirely too much, and contrasted rather sharply with his understanding of the evangelical liberty which had been promised by Protestant reformers. For the Anabaptist zealot, on the other hand, such measures were entirely too little. A betrayal of the promise of true and a godly reformation, but insufficiently rigorous in conception and in enforcement. Precisely because these Anabaptists did not find the same zeal in the clerics of the established Protestant church that they found in their own clergymen, and because they didn't find the moral improvement in the parishioners of the established church that they found in their own conventicle, these Anabaptists were convinced that the established church was a false church, wrongfully held erect only by the strong arm of the landgrave, justified only by a corrupt body of preachers for wages, who sold the gospel for their own worldly comfort. Under fire from the puritanical few who found him too slack, and from the many who found him all too demanding, the Hessian Protestant clergyman needed all the help he could get. The decade before 1538 saw experimentation with various expedients to rid the territory of Anabaptists and to secure respect and obedience to parish pastors among the general populace. They didn't work. These expedients and the failure of them, which is the immediate cause for the calling in of Martin Bucer by Landgraf Philip in 1538. Bucer succeeds where Hessian theologians fail. He convinced the majority of Hessian Anabaptist leaders to make their peace with the established church, and this successful piece of personal diplomacy was consolidated by the Ziegenhain disciplinary ordinance, which Bucer framed so as to meet the Anabaptist objections to the established church, but also to deal with this broader and more diffuse, with less acute problem, which I've just referred to, of securing respect and obedience to parish pastors among the general non-Anabaptist population. This legislation, this Ziegenhain ordinance, emphasized ecclesiastical discipline, authorized the excommunication of unrepentant sinners, established the elder as a parish functionary of the church, and introduced the semi-sacramental ceremony of confirmation into the ritual of the established church. Now I'm going to ask the following questions about this legislation in talking about it. Has the constitution or the doctrine of the Hessian church been fundamentally altered by the Ziegenhain legislation, and if so, how? Does the Ziegenhain ordinance differ in important respects from comparable legislation promulgated in Strasbourg 7 years earlier, of which Martin Luther was also the leading author? And if so, does this indicate either that Luther's ideas have changed or that Hessian authorities were more receptive to Strasbourg more receptive than the Strasbourg magistrates to his ideas, or both? And finally, what considerations govern the decisions of Bucer and the authorities in Strasbourg and Hesse? And I turn to the first of these questions. How now, in Hesse, is the Siegenheim ordinance? What innovation does it introduce? Now, with this ordinance, the exercise of ecclesiastical discipline receives a solemn emphasis, which is new in Hesse. The discipline of Christ, quote, the discipline of Christ, unquote, takes its place with the sacrament and doctrine as mark of the true church with this legislation. Excommunication was to be imposed upon those who were obdurate and repentant and unrepentant in showing contempt for God's word, or the clergy, who habitually absented themselves from religious services or behaved improperly there, who held false beliefs, who led a, quote, carnal Epicurean life, unquote, who dissipated the officials of church or state, or who engaged in blasphemy, profanity, robbery, murder, fornication, adultery, gluttony, drunkenness, usury, or slander. However, if we look closely at the conditions and the consequences of excommunication as authorized in this legislation, we have to conclude that the authority of the Hessian clergyman was not fundamentally changed by it. Throughout the 1530s, leading Hessian clergymen had been urging their Landgrave to authorize the so-called major excommunication, or to attach civil penalties to the ecclesiastical censure of excommunication. The Landgrave had persistently refused to authorize the clergy to set the civil arm in motion by excommunication, and he continued to refuse in 1539. Repeatedly stated that neither parishioners nor the officials of city civilians are to punish excommunicates on their own initiative. Whether and which civil penalties were to follow from excommunication were decisions reserved strictly to the Landgrave personally. The so-called minor excommunication, or exclusion from the body of Christians, symbolized by exclusion from Holy Communion, was authorized in 1539. But this minor excommunication had been enforced, at least intermittently and locally, and maybe more, it's not really clear, since 1529, I should say, throughout the last decade. Furthermore, the Landgrave and his advisors had been consistently uneasy throughout the 1530s about authorizing even the minor excommunication. And this easiness also has not disappeared by 1539. Authority to excommunicate, again, in the Siegenheim ordinance, was given first only to the pastors of the two largest Hessian cities, Marburg and Kassel. The provisions of the Siegenheim ordinance, which concerned excommunication, were not to be printed with the remainder of that legislation, but to be written out by hand and distributed only to the authorized clergymen. And we have only a gradual extension from Marburg and Kassel to the other large cities of the territory as far as authorization to excommunicate is concerned. Nor were parish pastors to make the decision to excommunicate alone, as the language of some earlier decrees in Hesse would seem to have allowed. Authorization also had to come from the district superintendent and from the parish incumbent of an office new to the Hessian Church, the elder. What is the role of these new officials, of these elders? According to the Siegenheim ordinance, the number of elders in each parish was to vary with its size. The elders were to be chosen for the more pious and respected of the laity, but they were nonetheless defined as pastors, who, like the preachers, were to be publicly installed in office in a semi-sacramental ceremony. The duties of the elders were, quote, above all else, unquote, to oversee the preachers, to ensure that they behaved themselves, were conscientious in their duties, and preached sound doctrine. But the elders were also to defend preachers, quote, against slanderous attacks, unquote, and to aid them, particularly in the areas of Christian education and Christian discipline. Now, if we keep in view the interlocking character of the two institutional innovations in the Siegenheim legislation, the authorization to excommunicate and the institution of the elders, and if we place them both in the context of the severe problems facing the Hessian Church in the 1530s, then the logic of the Siegenheim ordinance becomes clear. The Hessian populace, as I just culture. I have been restive under the new Protestant church, but for reasons which have to do with the scripture, moral, and educational standards of that church, for which neither many parishioners nor many clergymen were adequately prepared. So the authority of the church is not solidly established among ordinary parishioners, and the threat to its stability was increased by the emergence of the tenacious and outspoken minority of Anabaptists who questioned its legitimacy on religious principles. The Landgrave had been hesitant earlier in the 15th period to simply increase the formal authority of the established clergy, that is, they authorized their communication with the civil penalties. Because the established, the training, the diligence of the established clergy were questionably adequate for this task, it might simply increase tensions to the breaking point, so thought the Landgrave and his officials. But he also couldn't rely on his civil officials to support the clergymen in trouble. The Ziegenheim ordinance is an attempt to resolve this dilemma. He places unprecedented emphasis on ecclesiastical discipline, but at the same time, it provides the church with officials supplementary to the parish clergymen drawn from the lay nobles of the parish, as they're drawn from people who presumably would have the standing and the prestige to prop up the clergymen in trouble. So we have the formal authority of the church over its parishioners clarified and emphasized, but that authority is to be exercised by clergymen in conjunction with local men of standing who are to be their overseers, protectors, and assistants, as by the elders. However, this doesn't involve any fundamental, any significant constitutional change in the Hessian Church. It continues to be an authoritarian institution governed by the territorial prince. The Ziegenheim ordinance states that elders were to be, quote, elected or chosen, the bear term from the person. But in practice, the Landgrave appoints some when he chose to do so, and his officials played a role in the selection of others. The superintendents were the other functionaries required to authorize excommunication, and these men, nominally elected, but were also, in fact, in all cases, appointees of the Landgrave. I think I'll make it. I may have to run, but I think I'll make it. So, we have ecclesiastical discipline then authorized by a collegiate group, pastors, elders, and superintendents, most or all of whose members could be appointed by the central government and whose range of action, as noted above, was explicitly limited by the Ziegenheim order, that is, range of action in the area of excommunication. So we don't have, then, any effective area of autonomy of either the church or the local community from the will of the Landgrave. That is, this was neither intended nor created in 1539. What does change is the means by which the governance of the church by the Landgrave is exercised. The institutional significance of the Ziegenheim ordinance was not constitutional, but administrative. So the changes then, what I'm arguing is, introduced into the structure of the Hessian Church by the Ziegenheim ordinance were more limited than has sometimes been argued. By the same token, the differences between the Strasbourg and the Hessian ecclesiastical structures as regards ecclesiastical discipline were also more limited and are consequently less decisive in indicating either that the ideas of Martin Luther had changed or that his ideas got in more friendly reception in Hesse than had been the case in Strasbourg. More precisely, Hessian and Strasbourg authorities held common convictions on the larger questions of principle in the areas of the liberties of the church or the liberties of the individual conscience and the implications of these general principles for ecclesiastical discipline. And the Strasbourg councillors, like the Hessian Landgrave, were guided in the application of their religious principles by political and administrative considerations. Such considerations were different in the independent Republic of Strasbourg than in the territorial principality of Hesse, and this accounts for the limited differences in the resolution of the issue of ecclesiastical discipline in Strasbourg as opposed to Hesse. And I want to turn now to Strasbourg and talk very briefly about conditions there. The early history of the Strasbourg Reformation is largely a matter of clerical initiative, followed by ratification and modification by the city council. The councillors give conscientious consideration to religious questions, but they don't take the same view as the Strasbourg clergymen of their rights and responsibilities. They're governing a more vulnerable entity than the territorial state. They feel they have to take the ambiguities, I'm talking about the 15 points, in the law of the empire concerning the right to reform the church seriously. Nor are these counselors eager to restrict hard-won prerogatives by permitting the reinstitution of an independent ecclesiastical authority under Protestant auspices. The threat of their prerogative was not illusory. In response to what they saw as insufficient zeal among the city councilors, Bucer and his colleagues presented demands to the council, criticized the councilors publicly and privately, threatened to appeal to the public over their heads, and sometimes did so. The issue of discipline in these disputes was especially thorny, lying as it did somewhere in the border area of traditional civil and ecclesiastical authority, and having delicate implications for popular unrest. So it's in this setting of troubled relations between the Strasbourg clergyman and the city council, especially over the issue of ecclesiastical discipline, the office of the elder was invoked by Martin Luther. Not that he originated, but he invoked it in Strasbourg. He justified the office with the authority of the New Testament, and he sees in its reinstitution an aspect of the restoration of the purity of the primitive church. Business on exactly the range of concerns that Bucer wanted the elder to play in Strasbourg, but it's not all that different in the case in Hessen. Now, the elder is instituted in Strasbourg when the institutional structure of that church crystallizes in 1534. But the selection and the functioning of the elders in Strasbourg was shaped so as to minimize the influence of the clergy on their actions, that is, on the actions of the elders, and so on the exercise of ecclesiastical discipline in Strasbourg. Some of the elders, I'm going to summarize that institutional situation, it's a very neat arrangement that they set up in Strasbourg. Some of the elders are drawn directly from the city council, the remainder are initially appointed by the council for life. The conciliar members of the council, those drawn directly from the council, are replaced by nominations of the council, the others are replaced by co-optation. Ecclesiastical discipline, including minor excommunication, is to be exercised only by the elders in Strasbourg. Clergymen come in only as consultants. An examining board is established to deal with deviations from doctrine. This too is composed of elders and of city councilors. Again, the clergymen come in only as consultants. So we have institutionalized cooperation between elders and clergymen taking place only during the weekly meetings of the clerical convocation. During which meeting, both elders sitting with the convocation could refer any matter they wanted to directly to the city council. So we have an overlapping body of clerical convocation, assembly of elders, and examining board. And these overlapping bodies are carefully constructed to ensure that no authority slips from the hands of the city council. Bucer had conceived the elders as representatives of the lay community co-opted to the service of the church. As implemented, they function as agents of the city council within the church. Now, the whole position of church and clergy is very different in Hessen. It's the Landgrave who initiates and directs the break with the Roman church in Hessen. His clerical independence is chosen by him, tightly surveyed by him, and general counsel, and they were men of little independence and even of little influence on the Landgrave. Public criticism of the Landgrave to say nothing of such open defiance as emerged in Strasbourg over the issue of ecclesiastical discipline in 1546 was simply out of the question in Hesse. Even while the rumors of Philip's scandalous bigamous marriage were spreading throughout and beyond the territory of 1540, all but a handful of Hessian clergymen kept still, and the veiled protests of few were energetically repudiated by their own colleagues. The Strasbourg clergymen had much harsher things to say about their governor on much less provocation. So we don't then have any Hessian counterpart to the elaborate organization of the Strasbourg elders, the careful weighting of numbers, the judicious overlap of participation in different groups intended to limit clerical initiative, but they didn't need it in Hesse. The subordination of the church to the central government is not a Hessian problem, it's a matter of course. The elders in Hesse functioned then only on a parish level, and their numbers were left to local decision, as was the form of their cooperation with the parish clergy. Again, the Landgrave simply didn't find it necessary to regulate this matter in any precise and defined way. parish clergymen and superintendents share the responsibility for parish discipline, including excellent communication, with the elders in HESA. In Strasbourg, as we've seen, it's only the elders who are responsible. In both Strasbourg and HESA, the elders were directly or indirectly appointees of the central government, explicitly and by uniform procedures in Strasbourg, implicitly, and only when the Landgrave chose to intervene in HESA. In both, they were intermediaries in the sensitive area of lay clerical relations within the parish, and both they served as channels of information to the central government. But in Strasbourg, they functioned to check the ambitions of the organized body of clergy, whom the city council saw as an interest group whose influence on ecclesiastical policy had to be kept in check. In HESA, their role was different. The Landgrave faces a different and in some ways a more formidable administrative problem. He's got 400 parishes in his dominions, and not the 7, but a few little parishes in Strasbourg. And the zeal and the competence of the parish clergymen within this substantial and largely rural Hessian territory was uneven, and the average level certainly well below that of the Strasbourg preacher. So in HESA, the church has to be propped up, strengthened, stabilized. The elders might have to check improvements of the clergymen within the parish, but only there. The corporate body of territorial clergy posed no threat to the prerogatives of the central government, and the elders had no organized existence then, therefore, on the territorial level. In HESA, the office of the elder was an ingenious administrative device intended to compensate for the clergy's lack of standing in the parishes of a far-flung territory and for the local officials' failure to support them in their weakness. The pressures of popular antagonism were to be restrained and diverted from the clergy to the broader shoulders of selected groups of local notables, that is to say, of the elders. Now, I've got about 2 minutes worth of summary. Have I got time for that? Okay. Perhaps I can best summarize my argument by indicating briefly the contentions by some predecessors who dealt with this topic, which I'm arguing against. Hessian church historians have claimed that the Ziegenhain Ordinance fundamentally changed the character of the Hessian church by making the church for the first time an authoritative institution. An institution with authority to bind and to loose, that is to say, to excommunicate. And what I'm arguing is that this isn't so. That is to say, we had some, at least local and intermittent, use of the weapon of excommunication before 1539, and that after 1539, excommunication is highly limited in the way it can be exercised. Historians of Bucer have seen the Ziegenhain legislation in something of a different context. They compare it not to the Hessian past, but they compare it to what Bucer tried to do and what he accomplished in 1534 and earlier in Strasbourg. And so they focus on a different aspect of the Ziegenhain legislation. They've seen it as the successful creation of a church which is autonomous, at least in this particular area of ecclesiastical discipline. They've seen it as the creation of mechanisms of ecclesiastical discipline exercised by clergy alone and without interference by the lay authority and the civil authority. And I'm arguing that this is also not so, that if we look closely at the mechanism of ecclesiastical discipline in HESA, we see the hand of the Landgrave there on every important lever of that mechanism. Both of these groups of historians haven't seen the way in which this legislation actually works clearly and precisely enough, and the reason is, it seems to me, that they were looking in the wrong place. Or at least they were operating on too lofty a level, a level of general theological principles. In fact, and assuming that, which is the case, that conscientious concern for godly behavior among both Strasbourg and Hessian authorities existed, much more immediate and narrower considerations explain the differences in the application of ecclesiastical discipline in Strasbourg and in HESA. And what we have is a contrast which reflects in what I find rather intriguingly precise way of the different concerns of controlling clergymen and populace in an urban republic on the one hand and in a semi-autocratic territorial state on the other hand.
Heather, Bishop developments, especially political Protestantism in southern and central Germany, is well known. We moved now downstream to a group of territories whose history is not nearly enough well known, but the strategic position is peculiarly important in the resolution of the fate of political Protestantism in Germany. I refer to that group of territories, sometimes called, let's call them by all of their names, Baird, Mark, Kleve, Jülich, and Ravensburg?
Ravenstein.
Stealing my lines already.
So our next figure is John Dolan, a graduate of the University of Bonn, and now professor of history at the University of South Carolina, who will speak on Erasmian influences in the Kleve Church Ordinance.
In an official communique, which sent out the various chairmen, the overall chairman of this conference indicated that he would personally buy a drink for any local chairman who had the intestinal fortitude to stop the session at a lot of time. So,
being a drinky man, I'm going to walk out.
In addition to that, I might say that my good friend Tom Brady and I have occasionally shared a drink over the past 20 years, and so I don't want to be any obstacle to that affiliation. Early in this century, the German historian Franz Schnabel expressed the view that the Kirchen Ordinance constituted one of the most important sources for a knowledge of the inner workings of the Reform movement. At the same time, he regretted the fact that in spite of the work of the immediate Ludwig Fichter, whose Kirchen Ordinance appeared in 1846, there are still a great number of lacunae in this important source of 16th century history. In spite of the work of Salem and his collaborators, the complaint still rings true. This is especially the case in the region of the Lower Rhine, where the constantly changing religious fronts and the political vicissitudes of the principal electors of Cologne rendered the course of the Reformation an uncertainty for three decades. The failure of the reformers to capture the electorate of Cologne, in spite of three well-planned efforts, is often underestimated as a major factor in German history. The adjoining united dukedom of Jülich, Kleve, Mark, Ravensburg, Ravenstein, which, lacking a bishopric, shared episcopal jurisdiction among the dioceses of Cologne, Liège, and Utrecht, played a parallel role, its fate often directly intertwined with that of the Queen City of the Rhine. Sprawled along the north and east flank of Habsburg territory in the Low Country, and claiming for a time, 1538 to 1543, of the county of Geldern, which gave it access to the today, it formed the third largest complex of united territory in the Holy Roman Empire. Its acceptance or non-acceptance of the reform was critical to the foreign and domestic policy of Charles V. Known largely in history because of the somewhat exaggerated phrase, Dux Gefide, as Papa in territory of Sewell, and the ill-fated marriage of Anne to Henry VIII, its duke followed a policy of Erasmian moderation during the turbulent decades of the mid-16th century that is unique in Reformation history. Duke Johann III, who assumed the reins of government in 1521, was heir to a long tradition of state interference in the affairs of religion. As early as the year 1400, Duke William of Baird, taking advantage of the schism, obtained an indult from Boniface IX, exempting his subjects from appearing before the ecclesiastical court of the Archbishop of Cologne in secular litigation. This papal indult was extended in 1501 by Alexander VI to include the county of Jülich, and in 1513 Leo X included Kleve's Mark as well. William IX, 1475 to 1511, promulgated a regulation in 1491 that, among other things, urged greater respect for the sacraments and a better understanding of the liturgy. Johann's first important legislation in this respect was a decree dated March 25, 1525, proscribing Luther's writings because his doctrine is, quote, vain, erroneous, and heretical. 5 years later, dated July 1853, which stressed the need for improved preaching for bad religious debates and ordered the free administration of the sacraments. Johann had not promulgated the Edict of Worms in his territory, and there is little doubt that the Emperor's victory at Pavia had some influence on the first decree against the Lutherans. On the other hand, it must be pointed out that the Duchess Maria was a staunch Catholic. Hochstraten, for example, had dedicated his deal at Lois ab Inratione et Invocatione Sanatorum contra Perfidium Lutheranum to her in 1528, and she had a very strong influence at the Ducal Court. Melanchthon was especially outspoken in his denunciations of the Domina, as he called her, and he considered her as one of the chief obstacles to the introduction of the pure gospel into Cleves. The marriage of the Duke's daughter, Sibylla, to Johann Frederick of Saxony in 1527 had raised hopes that the dukedom would enter the Protestant camp. The Saxon prince had brought the former Franciscan Myconius to Dusseldorf, and with the approval of the Duke, he had preached in the castle there, as well as elsewhere in ducal territory. Erasmus had little regard for Myconius. He described him as a homo ineptus, a toned-down moody magister physicus. In spite of Lutheran gains in his realm, especially in Wessenberg and Born, it was not until 1532 that an actual church regulation was drawn up. On January the 11th of that year, an ordinance was issued at Cleves, and an interpretation thereto appeared at Magdeburg on the 8th of April in 1533. What was the actual contribution of Erasmus to the church regulation? If we are to limit it to external collaboration, it was very little. The stated purpose of the ordinance was the failure to observe the regulation of 1530, which is repeated in its entirety. In an epilogue, it is stated that preachers will soon be examined by inspectors appointed by the ducal court. Observance of the ordinance will be a decisive factor in their remaining in office. During the summer of 1532, the Duke summoned representatives from the four counties for a special conference and urged them to maintain unity in the matter of religion so that his reform could stand before God, Kaiser, and Empire. Although the councilors approved the regulation, they admonished the Duke that he was not in a position to introduce changes in matters of religion without the approval of a general or a national council. The councilors further stipulated that before inspectors could be appointed, there should be some clarification and explanation of the directives. For this purpose, a committee was formed. Most of you people are familiar with the process. A committee was formed to work over the difficult passages. And it was the decision of the committee to call upon Erasmus for assistance. There were a large number of Erasmians at the ducal court: Johann Platten, John Kograve, Ulrich von Daun, Alan Lambert Campister, Johann Kohler, material here for several doctoral theses, I suppose, and repeated attempts have been made to invite Erasmus to take up residence in Cleves. Chosen for agent in approaching Erasmus was the Chancellor Conrad von Heresbach. Erasmus at first met him in Cologne following the coronation of the emperor, and Heresbach had accompanied Erasmus to Basel and was assisted by him, that is by Erasmus, in obtaining a position at the University of Freiburg. At Erasmus' recommendation, he had been appointed tutor to young Prince William of Cleves in 1523. The humanist had also dedicated his De Pluris Instituendis to the young Duke in 1529. Heresbach, in a letter dated 15th of August, 1532, written to John Platten of the Ducal Court, who was a friend and correspondent of Erasmus, speaks of this decision. And in September, Heresbach began his journey to Freiburg, where he consulted with the agent Erasmus. The latter must have approved of the church regulation because in October it was passed to the estates of the principality and was approved by them. On the 25th of April 1533, Duke Johann granted Erasmus a pension of 30 gold florins per annum. Erasmus was informed of this by a letter from the vice chancellor dated May the 3rd, 1533. The letter indicated that Dr. Karl Harsch would deliver the money, as well as a copy of the ordinance, which he had translated into Latin because of Erasmus's lack of German. Verti in lingua latinum, Erasmus illum ordinationem intelligere, and ipse in lingua Germanica, non erat audio perfectus. The letter also requested that Erasmus write a little book to be used by preachers on the Lord's Prayer, the Creed, and the Decalogue. Erasmus responded to Plotin on the 25th of July, 1533, at the Feast of St. James. He indicated that he had read the ordinance and hoped that people would choose to follow it rather than hearken to the errors of those who preferred their own affairs to those of Christ. Yet he declined any further advice. He said, "It is most difficult, my esteemed Plotin, to give any happy advice in the present chaotic condition of human affairs. I myself would only suffer the consequences, because if I introduce anything new, the superstitious theologians who are causing heated disputes in Paris would cry out that Erasmus had found a new sect, that of the sober-minded." He continued, early morning session of any kind of gathering of this nature. There should be no dispute, he continued, concerning the Lord's Prayer. Even Luther wrote piously on the subject, and moreover, there is my paraphrase addressed to Eutychus Jonas. I have written comprehensively on the Creed, and during the spring my book on the Ten Commandments was published. Erasmus in the same letter indicates that he is working on the De Concordia Ecclesiae, Est Nihil Nocium Manibus, Libellus De Concordia Ecclesiae, Versus Cismata et Heresia. This is all that we know with certainty of the external collaboration of Erasmus. It was limited to the declaration, which he helped to prepare and subsequently approved. Yet any examination of the ordinance of 1532-33 and its various revisions indicates that they are replete with the spirit of Erasmus. The sense of church regulations and the interpretation are almost identical in nature, but we will try to reproduce them together. The first article of the regulation refers to preaching. The sermon must be delivered only by qualified and appointed pastors. According to the interpretation, this prohibition is directed against the following. First of all, against unqualified preachers, single pages, who either publicly or in secret stir up the common people to innovation and unrest by false interpretations of the gospel. It is also directed against those whose vocation is based upon secret revelation, supported by neither miracles or the message of peace. It is directed against monks who are uneducated and rabble-rousing. Only in special cases shall monks be allowed to preach, and then only those who are educated, and the contents of whose sermons have been ascertained by pastors and magistrates, to contain nothing that would lead to what is disagreeable and misunderstood. It is also directed against stationari, sellers of indulgences, which are still being peddled just like this. And any person whomsoever who causes religious unrest, it is directed against those who would do away with their own pastors. It continues, if there are complaints against any particular pastor, the magistrate shall report the facts to the Duke. The people themselves, however, must refrain from arbitrary actions aimed at removing a pastor or introducing a new one. Article 2 refers also to preaching. The sermon shall be delivered without polemics, shall be clear, intelligible, and pure. Its purpose shall be education in the recognition of our Savior Jesus Christ, in the observance of the divine commandments, in obedience, peace, and unity. Obscure passages of the scripture shall be explained by recourse to ones that are more clear. Where it is not deemed necessary, difficult passages may be passed over, lest the weak take exception. Allegories are to be explained through reference to the early fathers, Jerome, Augustine, Citizen. Article 3, which deals with the Creed, goes as follows. I'm not giving all these verbatim. It is the Creed's proper interpretation shall indicate that by nature we are all children of fury and damnation. God in his grace has offered reconciliation and redemption to all who embrace this faith. The faith is therefore no volatile illusion, but without good works it is dead, and without love of one's neighbor it cannot exist. Article 4, treating the Mosaic Law, as this Radmin notion. We celebrate holy days as Christians by listening to the Word of God, reciting Christian prayers, distributing alms, and repenting our sins. Haven't had any more warnings here, but I'm going to skip over some of these ordinances here. I have, in addition to the threat of flying a drink, I have to catch a plane. with regard to the sacrament of the altar, the faithful are to be, have explained to them that the holy sacrament of the altar really contains the body and blood of the Lord, also that the holy sacrament signifies the faith and meaning of evangelical harmony and fraternal love by which we are all united with Jesus Christ. And with regard to the confession, the pastor is recommended to exercise the greatest consideration towards his penitents during confession. He shall not ask them anything awkward, dangerous, or suspicious, by which the penitent could be angered or induced to evil action. In his admonitions, he shall avoid disturbing anyone, and this is best achieved by relying heavily upon the scriptures. With regard to marriage, the sacrament shall be administered without, or not be administered, without an explanation of its divine origin of the matrimony, or very definitely Catholic retention, and the Latin benedictions and prayers, so the Latin liturgy continues. Now, if we look at the writings of Erasmus, anybody familiar with him can see the Erasmian tone here. The preacher, as depicted by Erasmus in Ecclesiastes and other writings, is the ideal for passages of the Lower Rhine. Whenever Erasmus discusses the sacrament of baptism, he consistently points out the need for an explanation of the ceremony, the role of the parents and godparents in instructing children in the meaning of their baptismal promises. He writes, for example, to the theologians of the Sorbonne that neophytes be advised to listen to sermons in quibus idis illucide declaritor quod in se continua prosio baptismi. All explanations must be based upon the scriptures. Reference to the anxieties arising from the enumerations of sins and circumstances in confession, thus making the sacrament a burden to the faithful, are found in all his writings on the subject, especially in his Concordia and his De Preparatione Ad Mortem. The retention of the Latin language in the Mass and other liturgical actions was constantly urged by Erasmus, and I think this position is well enough known. The Church Ordinance of 1532-33 was never completely implemented. Inspections in Utrecht and to a lesser extent in Mark revealed a clergy completely lacking in the educational and moral qualities required of the Erasmian form. Four-fifths of them had to be classified as incapable. Of the few who, in examining the Bene Respondere, even less had the works of Erasmus. Efforts on the part of the ducal aides to collaborate with the ecclesiastical officials in Cologne also came to naught, largely over the question of jurisdiction and the Archbishop of Cologne. Negotiations which took place at Neuss, lasting from the 29th of December 1535 to the 7th of January 1536, with Herzbach and Platen representing the Duke and Johann Groper representing the Archbishop of Cologne, reached no definite conclusion with regard to any joint action of reform. If we look further into these ordinances, we find that the declaration sent by the Court of Pleas, and I'm summing up here already, sent by the Court of Pleas to the Religious Colloquy of Worms in 1541 indicates the continuation of Erasmian moderation on the question of the cup for the laity, clerical marriage, the sacrificial nature of the Mass, and episcopal jurisdiction, a via media, was maintained. Communion under both species should be at the choice of the communicant. Although desirable and praiseworthy, clerical celibacy should not be enforced. While it is acknowledged that there were many abuses associated with the multiplicity of private masses, the Mass itself was not to be rejected. As to the jurisdiction of bishops, the Duke's recommendation is that it be recognized in certain cases, such as his palaces. Duke William V, Wilhelm der Reich, who succeeded his father in 1539, was even more Erasmian in his approach to a nonpartisan church policy. Until recently, historians have traced his adherence to Catholicism to the folly of his Gelderland policy. There's little doubt as inspector of a Protestantized territory, including Gelgen, at his back, was a major obstacle to Charles' plan for the defeat of the League of Schmalkald. The prospect of William dying without a male heir and a Saxon inheritance was no less a factor. Charles sacked the city of Durham on the 24th of August, 1543, with an army of some 40,000 men. And this court, of course, forced the Duke to sign the Treaty of Venlo, which was on the 7th of September, 1543. In this, as a result of this treaty, all claim to Gelgen was abandoned, his French alliance, and the marriage to the Princess Jeanne d'Albert was rejected. The Duke was forced to drop his reforming efforts and to maintain the ancient faith. And the treaty was cemented in typical Habsburg fashion with a marriage between William and the Emperor's niece Maria, daughter of King Ferdinand. Yet recently published material from the Düsseldorf archive indicates that in spite of the conditions imposed at Venlo, there was a continuation of Erasmian policy in the Duke. A notel dated from 1545 proposes a church ordinance based almost completely on the Concordia of Erasmus. The Duke's acceptance of the interim on an equal footing with the formula Rata Reclamationis of the Emperor demonstrates that, though no longer Papa in territorial tuo, he still managed to maintain a via media. The Peace of Augsburg also failed to alter William's neutral policy. Catholic moderates such as George Witzel and Sanders were called upon to help steer a middle course between Catholicism and Papalism. As late as 1563, a proposed ordinance could still speak of due partes quae catholicam fidem protectentur, of the two Catholic parties. There was never a mention here of Lutheranism, but two Catholic parties. The last attempt to make the constantly revised church ordinance is a law in ducal territory terminated in January of 1567. On April 22nd of that year, the Duke of Alba entered Brussels, and as thousands of Protestant refugees from Holland flooded into Munich slave, William dropped all efforts towards the implementation of Erasmian church reform. Like Erasmus, he preferred tranquillitas to tumultus, and the memories of the Spanish fury at Durham were still very much alive.